Thank you for joining us for Hobby Radio, read by Keith, amateur radio operator W0NX, featuring the September 2024 The Spectrum Monitor. We'll begin by continuing Radio 101 by Ken Reitz, KS4ZR. OTA-TV antenna woes following hurricanes on Roku. Then, without any particular notice, the channel disappeared in favor of GRIT, an all-Western channel featuring a lineup of U.S. TV fare from the 1950s and 60s, when the genre was popular on network prime time. Obviously, as with virtually all OTA subchannels, they are offering nostalgic programming for America's expanding senior population. I would have to find another TV weather venue. Over the last few years, I've been exploring various uses for the online streaming device Roku. These are basically dongles that let you download various apps available through the device itself that can turn the device into a worldwide Wi-Fi radio, or watch movies on apps such as Netflix. Roku devices are very inexpensive, as low as $29, but require an internet connection to do the streaming. I've used Roku with everything from Wi-Fi hotspots from Verizon to Viasat Ka-band internet satellite. 2 years ago, our rural electric cooperative, with the help of massive subsidies from the FCC, installed high-speed fiber-optic cable connections to any home within the co-op's service area that wanted the service at a price of $79 per month. A spectacular deal for those of us who were spending at least twice that on Viasat and getting one-quarter the throughput speed. With the disappearance of Weather Nation on local OTA-TV, I was happy to see that it was offered as an app on Roku free. Having set up the app, it's easy to find on the TV via the remote control. A few weeks ago, as Hurricane Debbie loomed on the horizon, I watched the hurricane's progress as it approached South Florida on Weather Nation. Then I thought to use the Roku feature Live TV to see what channels from the affected areas were available. To do this, go to your Roku device, typically plugged into an HDMI port on your TV, select Live TV from the left-hand list, and scroll over to the right. You can call up the Live TV guide and pick from dozens of live network and local TV channels. Among them is a third weather-related channel called AccuWeather. Founded in 1962 near State College, Pennsylvania, AccuWeather has provided local radio and television stations across the U.S. with custom weather-related forecasts, as well as online forecasts for various smartphone and smart speaker apps. September is the peak month for hurricane activity, and now you know where to tune in to find local coverage. And now Amateur Radio Insights by Kirk Kleinschmidt, NT0Z. NT0Z at stealthamateur.com. Vintage equipment safety. Amateur radio cements lifelong friendships, makes the world a much smaller place, and provides years of ever-evolving fascination. And even if you're careful, it can still kill you, just like skydiving or motorcycling. Observing common sense safety rules is an integral part of observing good amateur practice. Start now, and you will worry less later on. A comprehensive treatment of safe amateur radio practices can be found in any ARRL handbook. You probably have at least three editions on your bookshelf, but if you don't, get busy and read up. Unless practiced without fail, your next lapse in judgment could be your last. Note, when it comes to the treatment of tube equipment safety practices, older handbooks may be a bit better than new ones. Most ham fatalities involve antennas, towers, and portable generators. Installing and maintaining towers and the antennas installed on them is inherently dangerous. Thanks, gravity. And accidents periodically take the lives of hams, even experienced climbers. Whether at home or in the field, when your antennas, parts, and masts contact overhead power lines, bad things happen. Most ham radio devices are powered by DC nowadays, which is inherently less risky than AC, especially high-voltage AC. But safety must always come first. High-current DC can still cause fires, burns, and even amputations. As some unfortunate victims have discovered, if your metal watch band shorts across the terminals of a truck battery or other infinite current DC source, the heat from the current flow can char or burn the wrist and hand to a degree that requires amputation. And, as more than one ham has discovered, shorting across the B+, high-voltage, line of a vacuum tube amplifier with said watchband won't merely require an amputation. The extreme heat from such an accident will completely remove the hand in a flash, but may require a call to the medical examiner's office, as the encounter will likely be fatal. Many hams older than a certain age have stories to tell about receiving shocks here and there. I know I do, and I've commented on them in this column previously. My most intense encounter with several hundred volts DC while adjusting an ancient military transmitter as a beginning ham probably came close to ending my ham radio career as a mere novice. Although I was taking safety precautions and being quite careful, the tip of my screwdriver contacted something hot, and I was thrown back several feet. After hitting the shack wall, I noticed that my heart wasn't beating, and then it was beating crazy fast, and then erratically, until it started beating normally, probably only moments later. I found myself wondering whether I'd survive. Obviously, I did survive, and I went on to build a fair amount of vacuum tube circuits over the years, even a kilowatt HF amplifier from scratch. I exercised extreme caution when working on this kind of equipment, and I still do. And I recently built a device that makes working on vacuum tube gear, especially vintage radios and equipment, even safer. It has a hilarious name, a dim bulb tester. But the need for such a device and what it can do to save your life and your vintage equipment is no joke. Read on for details. Vintage vacuum tube gear is alien. For most hams, after decades of solid-state-only gear, acquiring a vacuum tube radio or an older piece of audio equipment is an exciting and uncertain prospect. We haven't had brand new tube radios since 1980 or so, and if we pick up some gear made from the 1940s through the 1970s, and it has tubes in it, most of us don't have much experience safely wrangling high-voltage circuits. We don't know or remember all of the safety tricks, best practices, etc. So before we begin, we need to learn or familiarize ourselves with the important details of the circuits and how to test and refurbish them, all the while staying safe. In inflation-adjusted dollars, radios were super expensive back in the day. And just like today, manufacturers like to cut corners to save weight, costs, and circuit complexity. That these design approaches often put users' lives at risk was sort of a given. Nowadays, cord cutting and electronics gear doesn't inherently risk life and limb. It mostly reduces the lifespan and reliability of a particular unit, automobiles and airplanes excepted. For many vintage radios, amateur and broadcast, one very common weight and cost-cutting approach was to eliminate the AC power transformer, which was heavy in weight and in monetary cost. Most broadcast receivers made from the 1930s through the 1960s were notorious for taking this shortcut. Made by hundreds of manufacturers, these radios are dubbed All-American 5 or All-American 6 designs depending on whether they used 5 or 6 tubes. AA5 and AA6 radios are so similar that, once you've worked on a few, you don't even need specific schematics, as they're all nearly the same and have all of the same strengths and weaknesses. For purposes of our discussion this month, the biggest common weakness was the fact that they were built without an AC power transformer, which reduced costs but made each and every receiver potentially lethal to users and service techs. If the design decision wasn't so potentially deadly, it would be quite nifty. Instead of using multiple tubes with 6 or 12 volt filaments as the radio gods intended, the 5 or 6 tubes in AA5 and AA6 models had filament voltages that totaled 120 volts. When the filaments were wired in series, no power transformer was required. This is how we have tubes such as the 35W4 and the 50C5 with 35 and 50 volt filaments, respectively. Quite a few ham and shortwave receivers took this approach, too. The first that comes to mind is the ubiquitous Hallicrafter's S38 shortwave receiver. So don't assume that just because your new piece of vintage equipment isn't an all-American, it doesn't share this potentially deadly flaw. Missing power transformers. The power supplies in almost all modern equipment use a power transformer to convert 117 volt AC, or 240 in some countries, from the wall socket to whatever voltage is required to support the functions of the device. Yes, many of the latest designs use switching mode power supplies and more exotic voltage conversion technologies, but our discussion centers around more vintage gear. For vintage tube radios that have transformers, desirable, multiple secondary windings typically provide 5, 6, or 12 volts AC to power the tube filaments, 50 to 100 volts to provide for tube bias, often rectified as negative DC voltages, and 150 to 3,000 volts to power the B-plus high-voltage plate circuits. Typical B-plus supplies for receivers are in the 150 to 250 volt range, with the higher voltages generally reserved for the power amplifier tubes in the transmitter. The AC voltage from the secondaries is typically converted to DC by vacuum tube or silicon rectifiers, selenium, and filtered by chokes and electrolytic capacitors, more to come. In addition to providing a selection of necessary voltages, the power transformers also provided a critical function that's not as obvious: isolation. The primary side of an AC power transformer is connected to the AC mains through a wall plug, and hopefully a switch and a fuse, while the secondary side is connected to the radio's various circuits. There is usually no direct connection between the primary and secondary windings, and this isolation is the dam that holds back the full force and magnitude of the AC mains when there's a problem inside your radio. If a wire inside the chassis or a wire inside a vacuum tube shorts B-plus to ground, let's say, without a transformer and or some kind of inline fuse, the full power of the AC mains, essentially infinite for this discussion, can flow through that short circuit, whether that short is caused by a wire or by your body. A radio's transformer has resistance and impedance that limits the power that can be transmitted to the radio by the AC mains. And in all cases, you want that power to be limited. Another feature provided by circuits that use properly wired power transformers is correct wiring that can keep AC line voltage from appearing on the chassis of your AA5 radio if the wall plug is inserted backward. Remember, back in the days before three-wire AC plugs were common and required. The two-wire AC plugs on radios and other devices were usually polarized by having one of the two blades of the plug larger than the other. If your house and AC outlet were wired correctly, not a given, and your radio or the radio's plug were properly fused, again, not a given, it was pretty much impossible to reverse the relationship between the hot and neutral plugs, thereby preventing the radio's metal chassis from being hot with a near infinite amount of 117 volt AC current. Because we're having this discussion, you might assume that many of these wiring issues in radios and houses caused a lot of problems and a lot of shocks, and you'd be right. I'm sure they caused fires and even deaths. If you've ever noticed the back cover of a typical AA5 table radio, there are usually no holes through which you or an enterprising child can stick your finger or a screwdriver. You will also notice a printed warning about the fact that there are no user serviceable parts inside, as the manufacturer really doesn't want users to stick their fingers into a dangerous AC no man's land. Other potential problems. In addition to missing power transformers, vintage tube gear can have a variety of other issues that make it undesirable to simply plug it in and hit the power switch. Definitely don't do that. Many designs used a ceramic disc capacitor from one or both sides of the AC primary winding to ground that isn't really rated to handle the AC voltages present there over decades, or during occasional periodic spikes on the AC line. These caps, sometimes dubbed death caps, help keep electrical noise from propagating up the power lines, potentially affecting other RF devices. If that cap fails shorted, however, AC line voltage can be present on the radio's chassis or control knobs and skirts. And if you accidentally touch it, thinking that your radio is protected by a proper power transformer, you just might figure out why it's called a death cap. These caps should be replaced by modern safety caps, which are rated to go across the AC mains, or from each leg of the AC mains to ground. Safety caps are designed to fail open, which prevents the death cap scenario. Other techs simply replace the ancient 0.01 microfarad ceramic caps with modern 30 kilovolt ceramic caps. I don't know which is better, but I guarantee that either approach is way better than leaving the old caps in place. Some gear has the AC power switch in the wrong leg of the AC primary line. The same goes for fuses, if they're even present. Some radios supplied a two-prong AC power plug that has a pair of inline fuses. These are better than nothing, but these plugs and AC power cords were often replaced with units that conveniently had no inline fuses, so buyer beware. Perhaps more often than today, manufacturers change the design of radio circuits multiple times throughout their production runs, and they often didn't properly notate these changes in user and service manuals. Just because a potentially lethal AC line issue was fixed on revision F models, you can't assume that it's fixed on earlier chassis variants, or even a revision F chassis, to be honest. Tube gear from this era could have multiple dangerous faults in its power supply circuits, primary and secondary. To be safe, these circuits should be traced and verified before AC power is applied, even if protective devices are available. Many radios have been modified or improved by previous users over time, so components may be present that aren't even in the schematic, regardless of revision. Be careful. Vintage gear has often been designed to operate from 110 volts AC, not the modern standard of 117-120 volts. Most gear tolerates this pretty well, but certain radios are quite sensitive to increased line voltage, as their parts were right at the hairy edge of failure, even when the devices were new. So now, after 50 years of sitting around, running them on 117 volts may cause parts to fail. Whether your radio is a well-behaved and well-engineered rig, such as a Kenwood TS-830, or a Wild West Hallicrafter's S-38, when we work on vacuum tube gear of any vintage, to maximize our safety and that of the gear itself, we ideally want a device that goes between the gear and the AC wall outlet that provides isolation, voltage adjustment, current limiting, and a clear indication of what's going on from a power delivery perspective. That piece of gear is hilariously named a dim bulb tester. My dim bulb tester. My long-suffering YL thinks the name is extra hilarious. When I mentioned it, she wondered aloud why dim bulbs had to be tested and not simply discarded. After all, if a bulb is dim, throw it out, right? Indeed. Of course, I went on to explain that the bulbs, which hopefully glow dimly when an external radio is being powered and tested, are used as protective and diagnostic tools to safely power tube gear that's been sitting around for decades. And that, if the bulbs glow brightly, it probably means that something inside the radio under test is drawing way too much power, and that the bulbs glow brightly because they're absorbing a lot of that extra unwanted power to give me enough time to switch off the AC power before the radio's power transformer burns up or a capacitor or three explodes. For these testers, dim bulbs are good, while bright bulbs are probably not good. Dim bulbs for the win. A dim bulb tester has several key functions and components. These include isolation transformer. To hold back the near-infinite amount of electrical power that can be provided by your power company's service drop, 100 to 400 amps for a typical house, and to eliminate potentially unwanted circuits that might lethally exploit a wiring problem or component failure in your vintage radio, an isolation transformer must be employed. Almost all bare transformers are isolation transformers, in that the primary winding connects to the wall socket through a fuse and a switch, and the secondary windings connect to downstream circuit components in the power supply. But there is no direct connection between the primary and secondary windings. In a perfect world, and in simple circuits, this is almost always the case. But if the transformer is housed in a metal can or in a metal frame, and that frame is mounted to a device's metal chassis, the potential for an unwanted, non-isolated connection between primary and secondary exists. So unless you're building your own isolation transformer from a bare transformer and housing it in an enclosure that can't potentially connect the two isolated halves, make sure your commercially sourced isolation transformer is truly isolated. Amazingly, many aren't completely isolated as they pass through a chassis ground, even if the hot and neutral windings are fully isolated. We'll continue this article next time. Thank you for joining us for Hobby Radio, read by Keith.